The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator. And tonight's episode features two stories to put a chill in your summer night. Our show begins with Red Lights by Bill Dorsch. Our protagonist, Steve Collins, is an overworked and underappreciated customer service agent for a tech company. While on a red-eye flight to a client's office, Steve notices a vast field of wind turbines as he's looking out the window and zeroes in on the red obstruction lights blinking at the top of them. Normally synchronized, these lights are blinking at different intervals and in different groups. This sticks in Steve's mind, and his ensuing investigation will take him to a stranger place than he ever could have anticipated. After that, we'll wrap things up with The Farm by James Flynn. This story follows Ted Bloodsworth, one of the more aptly named characters I've come across. You see, Ted is a serial killer. Sure, he'll commit other crimes, but murder is what really gets his blood going. Ted is also preparing to relocate soon and wants to get in just one more dead body before he leaves. He opens his Tinder app and sees a pleasant, warm, unassuming lady named Ida. What could possibly go wrong? Also, as a special treat, voice actress Melissa Medina will be voicing Ida. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Bill Dorsch, I give you Red Lights.
Thank you. Have a nice flight.
The attendant said as she returned my boarding pass. How anyone could be that cheery at 1 a.m. was beyond me. I shuffled down the tunnel and into the plane, put my bag into the overhead, and collapsed onto my seat. Why was I boarding a plane at 1 a.m.? Because I work for the cheapest, penny-pinchiest, tightwad of an employer that you'll ever encounter. This place makes Ebenezer Scrooge look like Oprah Winfrey. My name is Steve Collins. I'm a 28-year-old customer service agent from Indianapolis, Indiana. You might wonder what a customer service agent does. My easiest answer is anything my employer can dream up. I am constantly sent on-site to our customers and have done almost everything you can imagine during those trips. Support, training, demos, deployments, and implementations. Heck, I've even had to give sales presentations and gather leads. They've shoved so many different hats on me that I could start my own online store. So, here I was, on the red eye from Indianapolis to Minneapolis. Red eye flights are much cheaper than peak hours, so even though I couldn't check into my budget motel room until 3 p.m., here I sat. After landing, I planned on a lengthy stint at the airport bar to pass as many hours as possible. Of course, that cost would be out of my own pocket, as this company had no such thing as per diem. To be honest, I'm surprised that they even covered the cost of the flights and the rooms when we traveled. I imagine they're either required to do so by some law or are allowed to write it all off come tax season. One of the few positives of red eyes is that the plane rarely has many passengers. This means your seat assignment is all but meaningless, in a good way. Once boarding is complete, you can easily spread yourself out, change from aisle to window, jump a couple of rows, and recline as far as you want. The world is yours. Outside of sneaking into business or first class, you're free to be as comfortable as you'd like. On that flight, I decided that I wasn't tired enough to sleep for those couple of hours, so I chose to curl up by the window in my row and take in the view of the lights from the cities and towns we'd be passing over. I'm not sure if that was the best or worst decision I've ever made. Interstate 65 is a highway that travels north and south from Indianapolis and connects with places like Bloomington, Lafayette, and Gary. As you drive northbound on I-65, a bit past Lafayette, you'll come across many wind turbines spread out as far as the eye can see. This is not hyperbole when I say as far as the eye can see. You can't see any land left or right that isn't covered in turbines, despite the area being as flat as land can get. It looks like a giant army of 400-foot-tall mechanical windmill overlords keeping careful watch over their land. In a way, it's terrifying. Imposing giants spinning huge blades menacingly at the passerby. Of course, these stationary machines can't do anything harmful, save perhaps the extremely small chance of one falling onto the road. The intimidating sight of such a huge object in such large numbers on a very flat plain of land makes it unsettling. The turbine would be just another structure stuck in the middle of a city full of tall buildings. But out here, where the tallest neighbor is perhaps a small grain silo, the turbine is the undisputed king. If the sight of the turbine army isn't unsettling enough, the fall of night brings with it another layer to the disquiet, the red lights. You've seen the red lights. Maybe you haven't seen these specific red lights, but you've seen the red lights. Atop any tall structure sits a blinking red light that alerts planes and other flying vehicles to its presence and height when it's dark outside. Now, imagine a giant landscape of these red lights blinking in unison across the entirety of your vision. The sight is equal parts mesmerizing and sinister. We're conditioned to approach most red lights with a certain mentality. They make you feel like you're somewhere you shouldn't be or doing something you shouldn't do. As I casually stared out the window, the plane began its ascent to cruising altitude. I was relaxed, but very much awake. It was a nice, clear night, so I could see the magnificent layout of the city lights. It was cathartic to see the grids upon grids of lights, perfectly laid out in their individual squares, yet working together to make a giant pattern representing thousands of people's homes and lives. I lightly rested my head against the window as I took in the sight. As the lights of Indianapolis faded away and we entered the more remote sections of the area north of the city, I began to notice the red lights. I was initially mesmerized, seeing this endless sea of red lighting up the landscape in rhythm. It was stunning, especially considering that each light represented a huge turbine that easily cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. However, it didn't take me long to realize that the red lights did not all blink in unison. At the same time, they didn't all blink independently either. It was as if they were blinking in groups, almost taking turns speaking to each other, back and forth, over and over. It was quite strange. There were very clear separations between the groups. Curious, and knowing that we would pass this site in short order, I scooted over to the other side of the plane to see what the opposite end of the expanse had to offer. As with my original side, the red lights seemed to be blinking in separate groups. I found this odd, but I filed it away as simply a fun curiosity to spend some time on the way to our destination. I quickly returned to my seat and quietly rode out the remainder of the flight. While watching television in my hotel room, I had my first deeper thoughts about the red lights. I had found myself watching the local PBS channel because of a lack of anything remotely interesting on my whopping 7-channel options. Did I mention that my company was excruciatingly cheap? Showing, at the time, was a low-budget program investigating unsolved cases and phenomena. The stories were mostly local, diving into theories and what-ifs about those happenings. It was pretty laughable, to be honest. The production value was terrible, the cases were paper-thin, at best, and the theories were borderline certifiable. What the show did do, however, was get me thinking about what I had seen on the way here to Minnesota. Why the weird groupings? Why break the groups off where they did? Furthermore, who the heck paid for all those turbines? Indiana isn't a poor state by any means, but there had to be several $100 million worth of those things out there, probably even more. It's hard to believe that the state would shell out the money for that, so it had to be privately funded. Our power company had been lamenting a lack of profitability for as long as I could remember, so I can't imagine they'd be footing the bill. While these questions did tease my brain, I had a long next day of work ahead of me, and I was quite tired. I figured when I got back home, perhaps I'd do a quick bit of research. While I didn't expect to find much information via a simple Google query, I had not anticipated having as much trouble as I would have getting basic answers. Not only could I not find who financed the turbines, but I also couldn't find out who claimed ownership over them. Logic would dictate that the power company would own them. After all, that's who was getting the windfall, pun slightly intended, of the energy output, right? But alas, nothing on the company's website nor in the public records had any reference to them owning an enormous wind farm spanning hundreds of square miles. One would imagine that, especially in this era of going green and the importance of a clean public image, the company would flex this asset as intensely as a bodybuilder would flex their muscles. Oddly, it was almost as if nobody even cared to acknowledge their existence. I did not let this initial roadblock set me back in my quest for answers. I would spend the next several weeks attempting to pursue any lead I could think of. I tried libraries, local politicians, utility workers, and even the governor. I imagined the look of bewilderment that probably graced the face of the leader of our state when reading my letter, if they even had read it at all. More likely, it landed on the desk of one of their aides, landing in the "no way we're bothering the governor with this" pile. Wherever it ended up, I got no more answers from the governor's office than I did anywhere else. It was frustrating, but it also stoked the fire inside me that much more. I was going to figure this out, but now it had become a challenge. My trips to Minnesota were no longer the tiring ventures that they had initially been. Instead, I looked forward to every trip to the airport. Each journey offered me another opportunity to study the twirling giants, albeit for a very few short minutes at a time. I took pictures and videos and paid for in-flight Wi-Fi to do research. I even asked passengers and flight attendants about them. I'm sure that last tactic caused some discomfort for the other people on the flight, but I wasn't thinking about that. I was laser-focused on getting any information I could from wherever and whomever possible. After several flights, I was asked, upon boarding, to refrain from bothering the other passengers going forward. I understood. I hadn't meant any harm, of course. I simply suffered from a lack of self-awareness brought on by a need to figure out this mystery. I hadn't made any progress anyway, so it wasn't a huge blow to the investigation. As a result of being confined to my solitude during the flights, I began to study the videos I had taken more intensely. It had occurred to me that there was a pattern to the lights, but I hadn't really figured out the pattern. Soon, this became the sole focus. I knew it could easily be a coincidence, and the pattern could simply be a dead end. However, I refused to write off the possibility that there really could be a deeper meaning to the groupings and the cadences. I spent weeks trying to decode the pattern. Having no experience in such matters, I studied different code mechanisms from years past. I studied codes from the modern day all the way back to the ancient Egyptians, trying desperately to find some correlation to the increasingly mocking light cycles found in the dozens of videos I had captured. Whenever I thought I was making progress, I would inevitably run into some discrepancy that would invalidate my path. Frustration gave way to resolve, though, and I refused to concede. I would press on. I was going to figure this out. In the early stages of my forensic journey, I separated my research from my day-to-day work. Several months in, however, I found myself sneaking time at work to dedicate to more digging. I was relegated to an out-of-the-way corner cubicle during my trips to the Minnesota client, and I began using this to my advantage. I didn't mean to shirk my duties, and I still ensured to finish the job. I just didn't work as hard as I did in the past. I tried to justify this to myself by reasoning that the company wasn't paying me anything close to a competitive wage and asked me to do far more tasks than my job title described. Therefore, a few minutes here and there was just me taking back some of the time I shouldn't have been spending doing those things in the first place. My newfound break time moments went under the radar briefly, but it would not last. Several times, I would be staring at the videos on my phone, oblivious to the visitor at my cubicle waiting to ask me a question or follow up on some action item I was given. Soon, I would notice that I was starting to get sideways looks from employees at the client's office when I'd show up in the break room to grab my lunch or a glass of water. People who had normally chatted me up would, instead, find an excuse to go back to their desks or not acknowledge me at all. My input during meetings would be met with increasing disdain or apathy, and my work was increasingly criticized. One fateful Friday afternoon, Teddy, a developer at the client's office, approached me at my desk. He was one of the more tenured developers, and we had always enjoyed talking to each other. He was probably the closest thing to a friend that I had here at the office. Thankfully, I had been diligently working on my current assignment instead of code breaking. I looked up at Teddy, surprised at the visit, but welcoming the interruption. "Hey, Teddy, what's up?" I asked. "Hey, Steve, how's it going?" he replied. "Not bad, just finishing up this report. Hoping to get it done before the end of the day," I explained. "The wife's hosting her new book club at the house tonight, and I'm heading out after work for a few drinks while the ladies take over the space. You up for a couple after quitting time?" Teddy asked. The thought wasn't especially attractive to me, but I never really got invites like this, and I thought that maybe being around everyone would warm them back up to me and allow me to at least lose some of the down-looking that had been happening toward me. "I suppose so. Who's going?" I asked. "Everybody else has plans already, so it'd just be you and me," he replied. I then understood the origin of the invite. It wasn't really an attempt at fellowship. I was the last resort before Teddy would be stuck at a bar drinking alone. Screw it. It beats sitting around at the airport waiting to head home on the 2 a.m. flight. I'd have been drinking in the airport bar as usual anyway. I figured I might as well have some company, though the invite was superficial. "All right," I said. "I'll swing by your desk and we can head out." We ordered our first rounds and found a small table when we arrived at the bar. The first few beers were filled with small talk, how the home life was going, what Indianapolis was like, how the ball game on TV was turning out, gossip about random co-workers, gripes about management, etc. I have to admit, it was much more enjoyable than I had anticipated, especially because I was only here because I was the last option. It was about an hour and a half into filling our bar tab that Teddy finally brought up the subject I knew somebody at the office would inevitably raise. "So, Steve," he said, "I like you, man. You've always been a good hand. I need to let you know that people at the office are starting to talk. They're saying that you've lost focus and that you're not confident in your work anymore. They're saying you're off in la-la land, watching weird videos on your phone and just generally being checked out. I don't want you to get in trouble and have someone call back to your boss and start a whole thing. Is everything okay, man?" I was surprised and somewhat taken aback by Teddy's concern. He seemed to care. If not, he was one heck of an actor. Thinking about it, he was the first person to ask me how I was doing for as long as I could remember. "I'm not surprised to hear that, Teddy," I replied. "Honestly, I'm not checked out. I think the wrong busybody dropped by when I was taking a breather and decided to start one of the old office water cooler rumors. Then it just grew legs and took off. It's kind of frustrating, really. I can't even get a recommendation taken seriously anymore." "Was it the video, maybe?" Teddy speculated. "Was it a bad video?" he asked, with a slight grin and a mischievous tone. No, nothing like that," I answered. "Well, okay, what were you watching, if you don't mind me asking?" Teddy continued. There it was, the million-dollar question. I paused for a bit, wondering if I should tell him the truth. I had already asked random strangers about my red light pursuits, so why not tell someone with whom I had at least some history? Apparently, the office folks had already cast me out into shun territory. How much worse could I make things by bringing Teddy into the process? Like, really, could I get shunned more than I already was? If Teddy ended up thinking I was a crackpot, I didn't figure I'd be too broken up about it. Besides, it's not like I've been making any tangible progress lately. Perhaps this would give the efforts a much-needed jolt. I decided to tell Teddy about everything. The turbines, the inability to find anything about the owners, the multitude of closed doors I'd encountered when trying to fish for any information, and, most importantly, the red lights. I shared my theories and my code-breaking attempts. As I was presenting all of this, I truly expected Teddy to slam his current beer, pay his tab, and leave, thinking me a lunatic. To my genuine shock, Teddy ordered another round and leaned a little closer over the table. "So, this video you've been watching is of these weird lights, then?" he asked. Almost subconsciously, I nodded in response. I pulled the videos up on my phone and leaned closer to share the screen with him as the red lights performed their infernal blinking for him. Teddy looked intently for the duration of one of the videos with a pensive look, absorbing the images as he sipped his newly arrived beer. "I don't know, man. Seems like it's just lights blinking. Kind of cool how many of them there are, though. We don't have anything like that around here. But what is it you think you're trying to find?" he asked. "I'm not sure," I replied. "I just can't shake the feeling that something is off, or being hidden, or just wrong. I can't explain it, really. I guess it's sort of like that feeling you get when someone's lying to you, and you know it, but there isn't enough there to prove it." Teddy checked his watch and looked back up at me. He paused momentarily and then said, "Okay, I know you gotta get going to the airport here and I should probably get back to the house. I'll tell you what, send me the video, if you're cool with it. I'll look at it and see if anything jumps out at me. Unless you want me to show it around, I'll keep it to myself. If I come across anything worth mentioning, I can text you or catch you next time you're in the office. How does that sound?" I agreed and sent Teddy the video. We settled up with the bar, bid each other a good evening, and parted ways. I hopped in a cab, bound for the airport, and thought about what had happened. I was hopeful that bringing Teddy into the mix would be helpful, but I also had my share of trepidation. Had I just fallen for a ruse intended to get dirt on me that could be spread around to the rest of the office? Had I just committed career suicide? No. Teddy was too genuine with his interest. If it had been contrived, he would have won an Oscar with that performance. I decided to stop worrying about the possibility of Teddy weaponizing the video I just sent him and, instead, chose to be positive in my thoughts, focusing on the possibility of another set of eyes providing a breakthrough. The following weekend, my phone buzzed. Teddy was texting me. Teddy:
Hey, what different code types did you say you tried so far?
Me: Morse code, tap code, Wabun code, and a few other obscure ones. I even tried matching the counts up to letters of the alphabet and applying things like Caesar shift.
Teddy: Have you ever tried binary?
Me: No, I hadn't thought about that.
Teddy: It may be nothing, but this clip you sent me looks like a 3 in binary.
Me:
Huh, no kidding. Well, if nothing else exists, it's a place to start. I'll start looking at my other clips and see if I can match them up with anything.
Teddy:
If you need a hand decoding, feel free to send me the clips you have and I'll help where I can.
Me:
Thanks, man. Really appreciate the help, and thanks for not writing me off as a nutbag.
Teddy:
Anytime. I hope you find what you're looking for. Get some sleep. You looked like a truck hit you when we were at the bar.
Me:
Thanks, I think. I'll be in the office in a week. Take care, and thanks again, man.
Binary? Son of a... That never even crossed my mind.
I sat for a moment, frustrated at myself for missing such an obvious angle, especially considering my employment in technology.
The tip turned out to be the breakthrough I needed. Things rapidly started falling into place as I worked through my video footage. A 5 here, a 9 there. Numbers started flowing from the digital abyss as I worked on translating and decoding well into the night. 3820351109395 83. Those were the numbers that I was able to derive. It was tricky. I had to review the findings several times before I could detect the repeating pattern. All the lights in all the groups flashed together at a couple of points, and I had to lean on Teddy for some input. He opined that they were likely either separators of some sort or the indicator of the end of the sequence. Considering that, I parsed the string of numbers into 382035, break, 11093958, break, and 3. Well, that did a whole lot of nothing, I thought as I looked at the strings written out side by side. I couldn't garner any new information from the breaks. I concluded that perhaps I had worked far enough into the night on this endeavor and decided to get some rest. The next morning, I was asked to visit a client about 45 minutes away to show them how to use a new feature we had recently deployed. I had never been to this office before, so I looked up the location on my GPS. While moving my finger to press the directions button, I accidentally tapped the map, inadvertently moving the waypoint. I was just about to re-tap the office location when I halted and stared at the screen. Staring back at me was the discovery that would blow this whole thing open. I arrived home after hurriedly canceling my appointment with a client. As I furiously typed my query into the laptop I had in front of me, I made a call.
Teddy.
Hello?
Me.
Teddy, it's coordinates!
Teddy.
Huh?
Me.
Coordinates, latitude, longitude, GPS, that's the pattern.
Teddy.
Whoa, easy. You mean the lights?
Me.
They're pointing to something big, Teddy, real big.
Teddy.
What do you mean?
The tabs on my laptop's browser were filled with information. 38 degrees, 20 minutes, 35.1 seconds north, 109 degrees, 39 minutes, 58.3 seconds west. The monolith. The Utah monolith was the destination of the coordinates and the answer to this excruciating puzzle. 10 feet tall and visible from satellite views, the monolith sat near a canyon in Utah's Lockhart Basin. It didn't take me long to surmise why this was the point of destination and what that meant for all of us. I spent the next month beating down the door of anyone within earshot.
I frantically pleaded my findings to all levels of society, from local podcasters all the way up to the military. Nobody escaped my insistences. Someone, anyone, needed to listen. Someone, anyone needed to help. Time was preciously short, and urgency was paramount. It didn't take many attempts at persuading the higher ranks of the government for me to find myself as I am now. My new home now consists of padded walls, my accommodations that of deprivation. I'm barely allowed any human interaction except for the few minutes I'm allowed to shower. During one of the walks back from my shower, I noticed a news briefing interrupting the usual television program the rest of the residents of this institution prefer. I almost didn't notice my wry smile as I glanced at the panicked newscast depicting the ships landing near the monolith. I tried to warn them, to tell them that these were landing coordinates being cast to someone or something above to get them to act. I tried until I was tired. Now, all I can do is wait, knowing how right I was. Hopefully, someone realizes that I was put here unjustly and grants me freedom. I'm doubtful, since that would require the government to admit a mistake, and I'd sooner win the lottery without buying a ticket. No, I'll likely be here for a while. But who knows? Maybe one of our new visitors has a soft spot for guys like me and will come to open this door. Until then, I'll simply relax and enjoy the arrival. You've been listening to Red Lights by Bill Dorsch. Bill is an avid horror fan from the northwest corner of Indiana. When not consuming horror in text, film, or games, he enjoys playing music, board gaming, and poker. He can often be found driving the country roads of Indiana late at night, enjoying many a dark audio tale while savoring a good cigar. And now, listeners, here's The Farm by James Flynn. Ted Bloodsworth exhaled a cloud of cigar smoke across the living room of his rented apartment. Smoking the last expensive Cuban from his wooden box, he relished the taste as much as he could, fully aware that it would be his last one for a while. Life had been comfortable for the last couple of years, and he had acquired a few luxurious habits. However, the money from the bank job was running short, and so now he had some choices to make. Another robbery? A scam? Or was it time to move on to a different town? These were pressing questions, but the most pressing question for Ted Bloodsworth was, to kill or not to kill? At heart, Bloodsworth was a serial killer, not a bank robber. The bank job he had executed 2 years ago was done out of necessity, not passion. His real passion lay in murder, strangulation to be precise, with the occasional bit of cannibalism thrown in if he was in the mood. Ted wasn't born a killer. His unusual tastes developed by accident. A consensual sex act gone wrong during his teenage years was responsible for flicking a switch inside him. A romantic camping trip with a childhood sweetheart, a bottle of wine, kissing and fondling in a sleeping bag, a bit of playful, aggressive foreplay, a hand around her neck, a little too much pressure in the heat of the moment. It had been completely unintentional, but due to this unfortunate slip-up, Bloodsworth had been forced to live a life on the run ever since, drifting from one town to the next, indulging himself in his murderous fantasies, staying one step ahead of the authorities and their warrants for his arrest. 24 months had now passed since his last kill, a personal record, solely because he'd been swimming in cash and spoils from the bank heist. But now that he was almost broke again and had nothing to lose, the taste of blood tickled his taste buds. Time to find another neck, old boy. Another neck, another strangulation, another mouthful of warm claret, and then it's goodbye, Mafarno City. At 45 years of age, Bloodsworth had a body count as long as his arm. In the early days, his MO had been to pick up hitchhikers or curb crawl for junkie hookers. But today, in the world of the 21st century, dating apps were far more convenient. Stubbing out the cigar, Bloodsworth picked up his phone and opened Tinder. Despite being convenient, dating apps were also traceable and therefore risky. But he took precautions. His profile photo was grainy. He used a fake name. And every so often, he would completely delete his profile and create a new one. His current profile had been active for quite a while, though, and there were a dozen or so messages in his inbox. The one at the top was from a lady named Ida.
Hi, how are you?
With a tingling in his loins and a dash of red behind his eyes, Bloodsworth typed out a reply. Hi, I'm fine. Fancy going for a drink sometime? When Bloodsworth walked into the bar, Ida was already there. Moving her bag from a stool, she gestured for him to sit down next to her. Ida didn't fit the profile of most of Ted's previous victims. She was portly, motherly, and inconspicuous in a way that could be problematic. If he had any intention of staying in Mafarno City, he would have walked out of the bar and called it a night. But all he wanted was a quick kill before catching a train, so he pulled out the stool and sat himself down. Putting on his best, sane, socially acceptable smile, he said, "Nice to meet you." Ida had a pint of fruit ale in front of her, and after returning his greeting, her first question was,
"What do you want to drink?"
Glancing at the bottles on display behind the bar, Bloodsworth replied, "Whiskey on the rocks, please." After chatting with Ida for half an hour or so, Bloodsworth almost felt sorry for her. She had a certain innocence about her. She was an open book, gullible, and every gesture she made and every sentence she muttered gave off the impression that she was prey waiting to be hunted. Or, in Bloodsworth's case, flesh waiting to be tasted. She also appeared to have money.
"I own a health retreat,"
she said, sipping her ale. Ted's ears pricked up. "A health retreat?"
"It's basically a farm where people can relax and heal."
"Sounds interesting," said Bloodsworth, sensing that he may have stumbled upon something valuable.
"I like to help people,"
continued Ida with an innocent shrug of her round shoulders.
"I organize meditation classes at the farm, yoga classes, and generally provide people with a safe space, a place where they can forget about the stress of Mafarno City for a while."
"A wealthy philanthropist? You've struck gold, Mr. Bloodsworth."
"Have you ever tried meditation?"
asked Ida, smiling at him admiringly. Swishing a mouthful of whiskey around his gums, imagining that it was Ida's blood, Ted said, "I can't say I have."
"Oh, you should try it,"
implored Ida, leaning closer to him.
"It's very therapeutic."
"Maybe I should."
"Come to my farm sometime. It'll be fun."
"I'm sure it will be," grinned Ted, his mind ablaze with ghastly images. Bloodsworth instructed the taxi driver to pull over half a mile away from Ida's farm, paid him in cash, and then walked the rest of the way. Situated among 4 acres of lush green meadow with a network of canals snaking through it, the farm looked serene and idyllic under the rays of the afternoon sun. Walking down a gravel path, a series of wooden huts came into view, and as he reached the second one, Ted heard his name being called.
"Ted, over here!"
Ida waved at him from the veranda of a large hut to his left. Ensconced in a wicker chair, dressed in white chinos and a floral blouse, she appeared to be enjoying a weekend break at a holiday resort. Climbing a set of wooden steps, Ted kissed her on the cheek and joined her. "Nice view," he remarked, gazing out towards one of the canals that ran adjacent to the hut, where a clump of floating plants drifted by on the murky water's surface.
"Isn't it just?"
agreed Ida. "Is this your living quarters?" asked Bloodsworth, for the sake of making small conversation, while inwardly wondering whether Ida's chubby body would sink to the bottom of the canal if he disposed of it in that fashion.
"It certainly is,"
replied Ida, nodding towards the hut's interior. Reaching for a teapot on the table in front of them, she added,
Let me pour you a drink, then I'll show you around the farm. This is the main healing building,
said Ida, guiding Ted along a series of stepping stones that led towards an elevated bamboo hut.
This is where I hold the meditation and yoga classes.
Climbing another set of steps, Ted entered the main healing suite with Ida and looked around. Yoga mats covered most of the floor, and four dark brown posts sat in each corner, forming part of the structure's foundations. Acrylic paintings hung from each one of these posts, each one depicting something spiritual and New Age-related. An illuminated body adorned with seven chakras, a floating figure in the midst of an astral plane, a cross-legged Buddha, and a star child emitting rays of pure white light. "Do you conduct the sessions yourself?" Ted asked, trying to determine whether there were any workers on the farm.
Sometimes, yes, but I also hire a professional yoga instructor now and again.
I see, muttered Bloodsworth, staring down at the yoga mats, wondering what they would look like with blood and semen splashed across them.
Are you hungry?
Asked Ida. Yanked out of his lustful daydream, Ted murmured, Huh?
Are you hungry? The kitchen is down there. I could get the chef to make us something to eat.
At ground level, 50 meters away from the main healing building, was a large kitchen area with tables and benches arranged under a canopy.
I'm hungry, darling, but not for anything you have stocked in your kitchen.
Maybe later, smiled Ted. Strolling around the grounds perimeter, listening to Ida relaying the farm's history, Ted noticed a small, concrete building by the edge of another canal. It looked older than the other structures on the resort, and unless he was mistaken, there appeared to be a trap door outside it. What's that over there?
That's the special therapy building,
beamed Ida, apparently glad that he had asked.
But only special clients get to stay in there.
In a somewhat flirtatious manner, Ted said, Am I a special client?
Only time will tell.
Giggled Ida, steering them away from the concrete structure and back towards her living quarters.
It's so hot. Let's get back to my room and I'll get some cold drinks from the fridge.
They drank cold drinks on the veranda of Ida's living quarters.
I like helping good people,
said Ida.
It's my passion. I no longer have to worry about money, so I put my time and energy into caring for others.
That's very admirable of you, remarked Bluntsworth, eyeing up the contours of her breasts that teasingly poked out from underneath her blouse and the silky texture of the skin around her neck. Clearing his throat, he added, So are there always employees and clients on this farm?
Well, my gardener goes home at 4 p.m., my chef leaves at 6 p.m., and my yoga instructor only comes here on certain days in the early afternoon. I also have my special therapy sessions on some evenings, though, like tonight.
Ted blinked in surprise. You have a special therapy session tonight?
Yes,
gleamed Ida.
I like to spend time with my special clients every other night, and tonight, a session is due.
Time for a rethink, thought Ted, assessing the situation before him. She will die tomorrow night. Feigning casual curiosity, he asked, These special therapy sessions, what do they actually consist of?
They consist of me providing comfort and support to a group of select people. My special clients are kind, warm-hearted individuals, and I find it immensely satisfying to soothe them and offer them a safe retreat from the dangers of the outside world.
What dangers? Asked Bloodsworth, acknowledging the irony of his question.
The world is an inherently dangerous place.
Sighed Ida.
It's ruthless, in fact. I mean, do you not watch the news? Right here in Mafarna City, we have hustlers, scammers, crooks, robbers, muggers, rapists, white-collar criminals, and just about anything else you can imagine. There are wars in the Middle East, wars in Europe, famines across the globe, pandemics.
Ida ran a hand through her glossy hair in a display of stressful agitation.
The world is a dangerous place, make no mistake. So whenever I meet decent people, I like to lend them a helping hand and protect them from the dog-eat-dog jungle out there.
Sounds like you're a decent person yourself, Ida. I like that.
Thank you, dear.
With a sudden urge to have some breathing space and a few minutes to think things over, Ted said, "Say, do you mind if I use your toilet?"
"Not at all,"
said Ida.
"It's through there."
The inside of the wooden shack was surprisingly spacious, and Ted cast his eyes around the place as he made his way to the restroom. A bed occupied one side of the room with a mosquito net erected over it, and a couple of cupboards and dressers flanked it. Ted drew to a halt as he noticed something on one of the dressers. A wad of banknotes, as thick and heavy as a house brick, was right there, sitting amongst a scattering of cosmetic materials. There was so much money there that Ted's first assumption was that he was looking at fake toy cash or Monopoly money. But upon closer inspection, he could see that the notes were real. Remembering his own dire financial circumstances, temptation cascaded down upon him, and he took another step towards the loot, preparing to stuff it all down his trousers. He resisted at the last moment, however, concluding that if he took the money now, Ida would notice the theft and refuse to see him again tomorrow. But if he waited until tomorrow night, he could have his carnal pleasures and then take the money afterward. Stepping away from the cash, he left it where it was. When he eventually returned from the toilet, Ida was topping off his glass.
"It's so good to have you here, Ted. It really is. I get lonely sometimes."
"It's a pleasure to be here. It's just a shame that you have your special therapy session tonight. Otherwise..."
"There's always tomorrow night,"
said Ida, her words laced with promise. "Tomorrow night," nodded Ted. "It's a date." By the time Bloodsworth arrived at the farm the following evening, he was hell-bent on killing Ida in the special therapy building. He'd spent the previous night weighing up all of his options, fantasizing about possible scenarios that could be achieved around different sections of the farm, but it was the image of the trap door that seduced him the most. The trap door suggested the presence of a basement, and Ted liked basements. They tended to muffle screams. The farm looked different at night. As Ted walked up the gravel path, the cluster of wooden huts and shacks became visible as jagged silhouettes cutting into a mauve sky, and an arrangement of hanging orange bulbs cast long shadows across the surrounding foliage. He found Ida in her usual position, relaxing on the veranda.
"We meet again,"
she smiled as he climbed the steps towards her. Ida's outfit was noticeably skimpier. She wore a skirt that reached halfway up her thighs and a different blouse that revealed a few inches more cleavage. Ted's penis bulged against the inside of his jeans as he pictured her splayed out across a dusty, grimy basement floor. "You look great."
"Thank you, honey."
"So, have you decided whether I'm a special client or not?"
"I certainly have,"
replied Ida, pouring him a drink as he sat down. "Well?"
"You're special, all right. I can see that now."
After pausing for a moment and acting casually, Ted joked, "If I'm a special client, does that mean I get to see your special therapy room over there?"
"Your wish is my desire,"
laughed Ida.
"But let's finish our drinks first, shall we?"
Ida led the way along the crooked stepping stones that cut across the farm. Reaching the special therapy room, she lowered herself to one knee and took hold of the trapdoor handle with both hands. With a well-practiced tug, she opened it, revealing a steep concrete staircase descending into murky shadow.
"They say ladies go first,"
said Ida.
"But I disagree, especially when it's this dark."
Taking the hint, Ted stepped forward. "Allow me."
"There's a light switch down there on the right-hand side,"
informed Ida as she watched him go down the stairs. After a few moments of awkward fumbling, Ted found the switch and the staircase was illuminated. Making her own way down the steep steps behind him, Ida said,
"This basement is a special place for special people, honest people."
"So I hear," muttered Bloodsworth as he opened a flaky wooden door at the bottom of the stairs.
And I know that you're an honest man, Ted. I know that you're special.
The door led into the basement proper, and as Ted searched around for a second light switch, Ida rambled on.
That wad of cash on my dresser yesterday was a test, Ted. A test of trustworthiness. And to my delight, you passed the test with flying colors. When I saw the money was still untouched, I knew I had found an honest, decent man.
Ida's words became unintelligible to Bloodsworth as he flicked the second switch and entered the basement. With the room's contents in clear view before him, he found himself dumbstruck, unable to process anything other than the macabre sight in front of him. What the?
And as I've told you many times now,
continued Ida behind him,
I like to protect decent people from the outside world.
The basement was roughly 40 square meters with a single bulb suspended from the ceiling. An array of coffins lined the rear section of the room, neatly arranged in a rainbow formation. The lid of each coffin was open, exposing a dozen shriveled, leathery corpses. A rocking chair faced the caskets in the middle of the ark.
This is my family,
enthused Ida, entering through the doorway behind him.
And I'm looking for a new addition.
Each cadaver was immaculately dressed in dress shirts, trousers, and shoes, everything ironed and polished to perfection. The few of them that still had clumps of hair attached to their scalps sported neatly combed haircuts. Despite the general dustiness of the basement itself, each coffin was free of dust, and the lacquered woodwork gleamed with evident daily polishing. One of the coffins was empty.
You have earned your place, my darling. I know that you're made of the right stuff, and it's my duty to protect you from the evil world outside.
Bloodsworth turned on his heel to face her. Dear, oh dear, lady, have you chosen the wrong person to fuck with? Let me tell you, somebody's going into that coffin over there, but it's not going to be me. Offended by his language, Ida's face dropped.
Don't speak to me like that. You're better than this. I know you are.
Letting out an involuntary laugh, Ted said, You're crazy, Ida. You're even crazier than I am. Under different circumstances, we could have worked together. But it just so happens I plan on leaving this shithole place for good.
There's no reason for you to go anywhere, honey. I can protect you now.
Protect me? I've heard it all now. Ted had heard enough. He advanced upon Ida, hands raised, and went straight for her throat. However, for unknown reasons, his strength seemed to have escaped him. Calmly, almost condescendingly, Ida pulled his hands away from her neck.
I knew you'd panic, honey. They all do. That's why I had to give you a little sedative.
The floor tilted, and Bloodsworth swayed on his feet, veering towards the wall. You spiked my drink?
I did what I had to do, my dear. It was for your own good.
Ted took another lunge for Ida, but it was like trying to hit a floating mirage. Her form became blurred and watery, and her outlines became indistinct. Eventually, all he could see was a swirl of colors in front of him. The room swayed and tilted again, a bump hit his head, and suddenly, he was staring at the flaky paintwork of the basement ceiling. A dark blob loomed over him.
Relax, my dear. You're safe now. Safe from the dangers of the vicious world outside.
Constellations dotted the night sky. Fireflies glowed as they flew over the slick canals, and foxes scurried in the bushes. The farm was empty, the staff members at home in their beds, but in front of the old concrete building, a soft, pale light emanated from the basement below. Perched in her rocking chair, encircled by men like a tribal queen, Ida glowed with warmth.
Are you all comfortable? How about you over there, Justin? Good. Well, let me tell you, it's been awful out there again today. The hospitals are at bursting point, vagrants are huddled in shop doorways or sleeping in cardboard boxes on the pavement, violent crime is through the roof, and the terrorism threat is now severe. Mafarno City is a truly awful place, my dears. And I can assure you all that you're not missing anything out there. The best place for you to be is right here with me.
Ashen faces peered out at Ida from the variety of coffins, each one in its own stage of decomposition and decay.
Don't look at me like that, Stuart. When I first met you, you were suffering from severe depression. Now look at you. You're the picture of health. You're in the best place you could possibly be, and you know it.
Enclosed within the upholstery of the polished caskets, there were slack jaws, gaping mouths, rotting teeth, and weepy eye sockets all around.
And how about you, Ted? Now that you've calmed down and settled in, can you see that you're in the safest, coziest, most secure place in the world?
Unlike the rest of the coffin dwellers, Bloodsworth's body still contained all of its fluids. He was going through his bloating phase, so his cheeks were a little puffy, his waist had gained a few inches, and his lips sat open like a fish. Yellow mucus seeped from one of his nostrils. After patiently listening to his reply, Ida nodded and said,
"See? I told you you'd understand eventually. I love you too, and I appreciate your gratitude. Just think, you have nothing to worry about ever again, my dear. You're in the safest place in the world."
Everyone present nodded in agreement, and Ida smiled proudly. You've just heard The Farm by James Flynn. James Flynn grew up in England. His stories cross the boundaries of horror, sci-fi, and sci-fi horror. An absurdist at heart, Flynn's tales tend to highlight the many paradoxes and predicaments that come attached to human existence. Flynn's work has been featured in several magazines and podcasts, most notably Black Petals Magazine, Yellow Mama Magazine, The Scare Room Podcast, and Weird Mask Magazine. When he's not writing, James Flynn can sometimes be found rummaging through shelves in secondhand bookstores or wandering aimlessly through the streets of the secret city in which he now lives. What a nice, cozy way to end an episode. If only all of us could be at a nice summer resort, enjoying a beverage and surrounded by good friends. And hey, these friends don't even tear through all your snacks. I'd like to extend my thanks to Bill Dorsch and James Flynn for this evening's stories, as well as to Melissa Medina for providing some fantastic character work. Be sure to come back next week for more scary stories to keep you chilled this summer. Until then, my friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.